So it is 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. It is time, as always, at 5 o'clock on Tuesday for Office Hour. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we're going to do what we always do on Tuesday. It's been a long week already, and it's only Tuesday. On Tuesday at 5 o'clock, we're going to go and knock on a door on campus. And here, there's the knocking. We're knocking on a door on campus to find out what is going on in all of these buildings here funded by the state and the taxpayers. What are people thinking about? What kind of research are people doing? And here's public affairs. What can we kind of introduce the larger listening audience to the esoteric and exciting and thrilling and sometimes perplexing things that happen on campus? And I'm very excited today to have somebody leading us into an area that we haven't talked about at all, though he's also associated with the English department. Don't think we're going to be doing standard English department discussion today. Today, I'm very pleased to have with me the Director of Data and Digital Scholarship. That's a great sounding title, Carl Stammer. So here, welcome.
Thank you, Naomi. It's wonderful to be here.
All right. And we're going to be talking about data and digital scholarship. What can the computers do for humanities? And since I mentioned that I was going to be talking about this, I've been collecting all kinds of questions from students and faculty that we're going to talk about, because it's a really fascinating topic and something that Davis is doing a lot on today. But as always, before we plunge deeply into the question about digital scholarship and what computers can do and help us rethink the humanities, we always start off with the same question. So we're going to start off with that today as well, which is we're going to ask Carl, it seems very unlikely that someone wakes up one morning and thinks that they want to do digital scholarship on the humanities, because that didn't even exist that long ago, right?
You know?
So how did you come to have this interest in the connection between your particular area, which is, I guess, would be called rare books and rare manuscripts and ballads from the British literary traditions, and then the computers, which come from a very different world? Now, how did you get involved in this?
So I really owe this to my mother.
Your mother, okay. Actually, I think for the first time, all the people that we've
really
been, who said that directly, that they owe it to their mother.
No, it really comes from her. She was an English teacher, so she had that as part of her career. But she also was a computer programmer. She was a Fortran programmer in the 70s, which at that time was pretty rare for a female. So really, females were the bulk of the computing industry, you know, at its inception, and then were gendered out. Mm-hmm. And so,
when did that gendering out take place? Do you know?
50s.
In the
60s.
Okay.
Started to, yeah. There were still some prominent figures that were really important, like the, you know, in that time, the modern library catalog was actually,
right.
That standard was invented by a female programmer.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, technology started to be thought of as a very gendered male profession. And for whatever reason, my mom bucked that trend and maintained this interest and learned how to program in Fortran. And I had been mostly more on the literary side as a kid. I mean, I always was a big reader and just loved that world, but became acutely aware pretty early on that there was just no way I was ever going to be able to read it all. That there was this
feeling of stepping into a library and feeling there's just too much there.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And knowing that in my mind, I really meant like I could never know with any surety that I had this selection problem. So any hypothesis I formed would be locked in that world. But luckily, my mom, to kind of keep me busy, had taught me how to computer code. So I grew up in the house where this was happening, and she taught me how to flowchart and design and think. But I really still wasn't very tech-oriented until I got, did some stuff in high school. But I was in the Marine Corps in the 80s, and I had an opportunity to see this thing, the predecessor to the internet, called the ARPANET and the MILNET. And when I first saw the extended network, like the big network that was being created, it was an aha moment. I really had this like mind-blowing moment where I said, someday it will all be here. Mm-hmm. Like all of the texts, the entire library will be here and it will be in digital form and I'll be able to get to it. I won't be able to read it, but the computer will. Mm-hmm. I knew enough from that experience with my mom to know that it was scalable, mm-hmm. right?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting story in many ways. But, I mean, I think some people find it reassuring that there's more in the library than they could read. And and clearly you didn't find that a reassuring story. For you, there was something, I think, that was sort of distressing about that story. So I'm just curious that, in other words, how that sets up your attitude towards the computer is something that can be helpful as a way of you're not worried about it replacing you. You see it as doing some task that you couldn't do on your own.
Absolutely. Okay. I see. I think that the there's just not a threat that it will ever replace. As a human, I'm in an interpretive space, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And my interpretation will always be my interpretation mm-hmm. and will always have value. Mm-hmm. And that's true of any reader mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. any position. Mm-hmm. And even if we imagine some future world of artificial intelligence where computers are making interpretive moves, we're not really there yet. They're doing some interesting things. But even if we thought game that out, at the most, it simply becomes another intelligence, another collaborator, the same as if I were talking to another person. Mm-hmm. It's never, I don't feel any threat mm-hmm. of it sort of taking away that human perspective. And I, you know, part of being me in my own head, too, is I do think there's something unique and a little bit magical about being human.
Right.
Right.
But the disadvantage is, I mean, and again, it goes back to this story, but the disadvantage is that a library can have at least the fantasy of totality. You know, you can have the idea yeah. that the library somehow includes everything and that the human can never include everything, at least sort of in that story. Yeah. Would you give me that?
Totally, yeah, totally.
Some way
yeah.
that it I mean, can I think, include everything. Yeah. Okay, so we've got you now having this moment, but well-trained by your mother and then running into the powerful computers that they had in the military. But why this particular group of British materials that interest you, their political pamphlets and their among more rare material. So why this particular group? It isn't like, for example, people who read fairy tales when they were young. I can't imagine you read this material as a child because it's a fairly esoteric place to put yourself down in, you know, with in terms of studying.
Yes, I did not read these as a child. That's right. For certain.
Well, you meet all types.
Yeah.
You meet all types on the, you know.
But mostly, I think you probably wouldn't have met anybody because they're so rare in some way that they were unavailable.
Uh-huh.
Like prior to the digital age, these broadside ballads, which is, you know, and broadsides in general, these one sheet publications were only available in special collections libraries. You had to have the super secret stamp to go in.
Right.
So there was no access. But the interesting thing about it is the reason they're so rare is because they were the most prolific and most popular thing mm-hmm. of their day. Mm-hmm. They're the street literature of the day. Mm-hmm. So they're not the rarefied canon,
right.
which was carefully curated from a particular perspective to do a particular kind of work. And so I've always been suspicious of that. I'm also a punk rock kid from the 80s, right? And some suspicion of that. The hegemony of the canon and that particular corpus, it is the street literature of the day. Mm-hmm. And in its time, it was, you know, maligned by everybody as being cheap print and not worth a lot, but by the same token, read by everyone.
Right.
Rich, poor, right. male, female. You know, everybody read these things.
So, and totally, it's like the most annoying thing now is walking down the street is getting the pizza coupon put in your hand, right?
Yep.
But, I mean, it isn't exactly equivalent to the pizza coupon. So maybe you can help us for the listeners to talk about, we were talking about this literature, 16th, 17th century England. And what, if somebody was reading one of these pamphlets, what kind of things might be in the pamphlets?
They would be everything from the fantastic, so tales of, you know, monstrous creatures mm-hmm. roaming the highlands somewhere, Interestingly, almost always beginning with a, you know, record of who witnessed it. And this is why we're telling you, so posed as news of the day. Mm-hmm. There, the a lot of the classic tales, though, that we do know, like Robin Hood was born. That story is from the ballads. That's where that story was told.
Uh-huh.
Right. So there's a lot of what we think of as even today popular literature that comes from there. There was, I mean, direct criticism and critique of, you know, the king and the queen and the power structures that be, much to the peril of printers often, because that's when you could go to the Star Chamber and just be put
to
death.
Get in trouble, yeah.
You know, so it really covered the range of, and in fact, one of the things I like to say is the range of discourse, right?
Mm-hmm.
That really comes down to my interest. I think it's the best window we have conceivably of really what were all of the topics that people were talking about,
mm-hmm.
because they responded to that. If suddenly somebody on the street was telling some new story or talking about some new thing, there would be a broadside that would hit the streets for sale for a penny and a half, mm-hmm. you know, that next day.
And there might have been gossip that went on in the farmer's market, but that you don't have access to.
Right.
Okay. So you've got this. So what we're talking about today then is all the things that you're going to say are going to be about this particular set of, I think you said there's something over 7,000 of these pamphlets that have now been put online. So they've now been digitized, which I think people understand that idea. So now the question is, this is just an example for us of the much larger question. What do people do with computers when they study literature and all the things we study in the humanities? So what can we then do with computers to learn about these 7,000 documents that have now been scanned and digitized and put in and are now available? And it seems to me some of what we do is we can do things that we could do before, but we can do them way faster. You know, we can do certain types of analysis that we if we had enough undergraduates doing research projects, we could do it that way as well. But they need to go out and get food. They have bathroom breaks. They so there's a kind of which in which they replicate human analytic power, but they're just that, you know, just on a much larger scale. Right. Is that one way to think about it?
That's one way. And that's, I don't want to belittle that way. It's very valuable. Right. I mean, we do need things like just word counts. I mean, a lot of scholarship is just based on the emergence of a new word and the number of times that it appears somewhere. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a common trope in literary scholarship, or a common function that we would look at. So things like that, I mean, just being able to put things in their particular order and read 1,000 of them, you know, so those kinds of tasks are actually really valuable, but they're most valuable.
Right. But before we move on, I just want to talk a little bit more about these valuable things they can do.
Yeah.
Because one thing is that they do them way faster.
Way, 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 way faster.
Exactly.
Right.
So I think that's one thing to think about. There's a way in which it just speeds up scholarship in a way we might not have been able to imagine before, with things taking literally seconds that might have taken decades before.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I'll give like the sort of just a concordance, which was that's a way of saying here's every word that appears in my entire corpus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And an index to them, the pages it appears upon, that kind of thing. I mean, that used to be the life's work of people, right?
Yes.
And I just ran one of those on the entire Library of Congress newspaper collection, 760 terabytes of text, just raw text. I mean, it's millions of documents. Right, that this is being run on, and we can produce that concordance in a matter of minutes. Right, what would have been, and that would have been impossible. That corpus is so large, impossible. There are people like the complete works of St. Thomas Aquinas, the complete works of Plato. Those are famous examples. People literally spent their entire careers with the help of their graduate students, like producing these reputable concordances, right? So it's the scale is insane. I mean, how much better and faster? And there are issues, and I'm sure we'll get to those. And, you know, there are issues and limitations to what the computer can do. But the one thing about the computer is it never makes a mistake. You can give it poor direction, which will give you results that are mistaken, that your interpretation of them is wrong. But if you say find the word Plato, it will never miss it.
Right.
If it is in fact there ever it,
that's
it
right.
gets it right.
Because it's just not
every
creative
time.
Enough to make a mistake.
Exactly, that's
There's
right.
No, if you're
doesn't
not creative,
make, yeah.
you don't make mistakes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we all understand this idea. And I do think it is a very interesting concept that does take a little bit of while to really sort of understand. It's just how much faster it is to deal with lots of material. And that example of all of the newspapers is terrific. I think it gets more complicated from there, as you were beginning to talk about, to the things that are not just sped up human action, but are what we would consider things that we couldn't have analyzed before. And I think in your example, you talk about the fact that there's aspects of the watermarks and the paper that maybe some of them might have been available if somebody had had enough time and energy to become a specialist. But we're beginning to talk about some ways in which computers, could we say, can see things in the scan that humans just simply couldn't have tried to measure.
Absolutely. And that comes down to the kind of scan often, mm-hmm. or things you can do post-processing of a scan. So a classic example of this are corrections on a manuscript.
Right.
Right? Where, you know, we have a manuscript and where people... So a really good example is the early manuscripts of the Declaration of Independence. Right. Where scholars spend forever like trying to figure out what is the word that was crossed out there? Like what was actually the process? What were they going to say before the word people was used? Right. And this is a real example, actually, where there's been a lot of debate
yeah.
over, you know, we the people, that people was not actually the original word. There was some scratching out and new and, you know, humans spend forever, you know, holding up to a light, various ways to try to see what these differences are. And what we do is we take different kinds of pictures. Mm-hmm. This thing called a hyperspectral scan. You can do this by taking a particular photo or by, even if you already have the photo, you can use Photoshop or a number of different packages to break that photo up according to its color spectrum. And what you'll see is things that were, you can produce a page where what you see is completely just disappears. And the thing that was hidden underneath where you scratched out is totally revealed. Like it's like it was never ever covered up.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
And so
like a time travel.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. Right. And so you produce these views of the document where you can watch it evolve. And we have that too, just where things have been damaged.
So don't right? leave us hanging. Yeah. What was
I knew
under
you're
the
ask
word?
Me that, I don't remember. Subject actually. I do know subject was one of the words that was there, and that was eliminated.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I don't
if it
remember
didn't say
all the
aliens,
variations.
I'm not.
No,
that
it didn't say alien, but
in...
I do think that switch. I do remember subject was one of them. That's an interesting switch because it's sort of saying no, we're not going to make the people in any way described as subject to this new government, right? We want to actually get away from that terminology, and that does tell us a lot about the kind mm-hmm. of thinking. Mm-hmm. That was going on.
So give us some examples then on your particular corpus, things on the broadsides, that the pamphlets that you could see by looking at. I don't imagine those were corrected very much. So I wouldn't think that would be particularly helpful. So what kinds of things can you see by breaking down these scans so much in such more detail?
Yeah. So with that, you're right. That particular technique, we don't use a lot on the ballads.
Yeah.
We use other techniques, beta radiography. It's a sort of taking an X-ray, things that reveal the what we call the watermark. So for those of people that aren't familiar with that, in the papermaking process, we still see this in some modern expensive paper.
Yes.
Right, where you hold it up to the light and you see
really
like the brand name or something there. This was virtually always done back in the day. And it was because papermaking was a labor-intensive process, actually. I mean, it was an art, right? And so it was a way of stamping that and knowing this is where this came from mm-hmm. and who did that. And so being able to identify that helps us start to piece together. One of the things about my period is authors and publication dates were not on these. Authorship is a relatively modern concept, except with very rare exception where the person was already politically famous in some way, typically. So you'd want to note them as an author. So you don't have that, and you don't know the actual date that things were published, right?
Right.
That's a big issue. especially if you're trying to piece together like the history of ideas.
Probably right? Over a fairly large range of time. That was certainly true in the older texts that I work on. We're kind of guessing around, and we're not talking about a 2-3 year period, often probably a 100 year period.
Exactly. If we can get like a 50 year range on something, you think that's really good, right?
Yeah.
And what I remind people is, I have to adjust this metaphor because I've been saying it for a while, but you know, it's like Reagan to Obama. You know what I mean? Like, that's a long spread if you think about it in terms of your contemporary history.
Right.
Well, if we're conflating those things and saying that they were at the same time, that is really, really hurts our ability to make solid arguments and to really understand how one idea flows to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And so a watermark, it can help us in that regard, because we may see that watermark. We know that it belongs to a particular batch of paper at a particular printer or publisher, because that paper also was found in some book or some other legal document that did have a date on it,
mm-hmm.
right? And if we know, okay, that batch of paper belonged to this person at this time, and we have other examples where it was dated, we can start to say, well, this thing had to have come off the press
mm-hmm.
in roughly this range. And that starts to bring that down, because the paper was very rarely, it wouldn't have been stored. It wasn't warehoused and stored for a long time. Because
it
was just used. It was expensive, and they don't have climate controlled places where the rats aren't going to get to it and the bugs, and right. So if it was bought and used, and mm-hmm. so that is really useful to us. And the other marks on the paper, dealing with the paper making process, you have these wire and chain lines,
mm-hmm.
which is how paper is made. There's this; it leaves an impression on the paper if you have the right kind of picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, so we can know, like, what physical apparatus
made that,
was used to make that. Right? And even that, we can watch those. They spread. They're called wire and chain. The chain was actually a piece of wood, but the wire were literally wires that were put there, and they would spread over time. And you can actually even know, like, what was the order at which this paper was made,
mm-hmm.
right? Was this from the beginning of the print run, or was it from the end of the print run?
So in this particular case, always, we're realizing you could do this on a lot of different ones. We're just using your example as the example for today. Did you find anything that was really surprising when you add the level of being able to look at the watermarks and tell what order they were made, and you know all this stuff about the paper, you know about the mode of production, or did it pretty much just sort out the main outcome of this all was you were able to be much more specific about particular times when things were made? But it was just sort of more sorting. There wasn't anything that was really very, very upsetting or shocking or surprising.
Yeah, I mean, so we're learning, I'll talk about a historical example first, because I think this is apropos to the earlier question about the scale of things, right?
Uh-huh.
So these techniques were the techniques that were used to, as far as most scholars are concerned, definitively prove that the Gutenberg Bible is in fact the oldest existing thing printed with movable type. Prior to that, there was this other, the Constance Missal, which the Pierpont Morgan Library owns, that everybody actually thought that was the oldest. And this guy, Wilkins, spent literally his whole career basically doing exactly this, measuring wire and chain lines, looking at watermarks, putting the whole thing together to solve the riddle with one book, right? And it changed our whole sense of print history because of that. With the ballads, what we're finding, and I want to emphasize finding, because in many ways, I've spent 20 years of a career getting to the point where we have the raw materials to do the analysis. So, and I really mean that. So for me, I'm at the most exciting time in my career. Most everything I've done to date has been prep work, like just getting the stuff digitized, getting the things we need to do that. But already we are definitely seeing that the overall print landscape is much more dynamic than we thought it was. And again, because the other thing is, we didn't know the difference between, like, we in the modern day, we talk about printers and publishers.
Right.
Right. So the publisher back in that day was like, who was licensed to legally sell this? Because you had to get a license to print anything back in the day. You couldn't just print something, you go to jail. But the printer was who actually physically owned the printing press, managed the process, and made it print. And though quite often not distinguished. You don't know, people have conflated them for years as being the same person.
Because it was hard to separate.
Because there was, there's no real record, right? Well, now we can start to do that. And what we do is we start to see that there are definitely ideological patterns at play. And we knew this with some of the larger famous printers, that printers just specialize. Like a certain, if you want to print something that's going to, you know, cut the queen a little bit, like that guy will print it.
Yeah. You know? And he's the only one.
And he's the only one, right?
Yeah. You go to him.
And so with this, we can start to say, like, look, we know, you know, and we also are trapping physical type. We haven't talked about that, but various ways where it's allowing us to really see that people were, many more publishers were actually farming things out to different printers in a very, very, very dynamic way in order to get things done that they wanted to get done, right? And kind of circumvent sometimes a very complex monopoly of printing and licensing that was in place at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the thing we haven't talked about is just in general the reusability. And that's also a big issue for me in the broadsides. Is so for those that are listening and haven't seen one, they're a single sheet, a large single sheet, and they typically contain text.
And a few.
And images.
Images,
woodblock prints on there, right? And what's really interesting, and sometimes if it's a ballad, a tune reference, like this should be sung to this tune, right? So you have sound, image, text. They're designed this way on purpose because you want to attract a quasi-literate readership, right? And I say quasi-literate on purpose because literacy is much, there are many more people who are literate than people think. Like, I think most people look back into the 16th, 17th century and think, well, no one could read but the nobility. And it's actually just not true. There's pretty good documentary evidence that, you know, about 50% of the population of London was functionally literate.
And a lot of people were picking these up to do something with them.
Yeah, right. You know, so, yeah. So, yeah. But having a picture there helps someone work through and tell a tale. And there's a lot of modularity in that. So, for example, there's one ballad that I'm particularly interested in, where we see this woodblock image, clearly meant to be the king, used in the context of several texts that are completely laudatory, like this is how great the king is and all this wonderful thing that's happening. And then all of a sudden, we see this same image, and it's a ballad about cuckoldry, right? And, you know, it's this very bawdy kind of thing. And it's obviously a critique, right?
So someone said, anybody got the guy down the street's the guy who's got the king. And so you run down the street and you borrow it from him.
And you borrow it from him. And then this other guy prints it. And we know he printed it because of the paper that it's on, right? Uh-huh. And you realize that all of these people, some, you know, supposedly like very reputable who would never, ever critique the king, are actually allowing their stuff to be moved around, reused, right? And of course, you can always come back and say, well, no, we just needed a picture of a guy on a horse. That's all, right? It's not the king, you know? And so that's how you avoid prosecution, right? But everybody knows it's the king, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, so there's a lot of that going on.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm particularly interested in this recombination and thinking about how the printing press and the ballad, and I'm particularly interested in the modern technological context. We think of hypertext, of the internet, of creating like reuse and sampling, and this is a new thing, but in fact, it's not. It was the order of the day as soon as we started mechanically reproducing things.
Then things became interchangeable.
Yeah.
And it was almost you just convenience and human nature to share and have these things be very dynamic. So there's something kind of reassuring about that.
Yeah, very much so, right? I mean, that it's our process, right?
So I want to talk a little bit more about computers, but I want to pause on this question because it's around this discovery of topics that you brought in something which I thought sort of jumped a little bit away from computers and into how to use computers to then speculate a little bit. And I think that's an interesting kind of a bridging of thinking there, because you talk about the fact that you found a certain number of topics repeated over and over again. So you sort of can put a finger then on these are topics, and it was broad. In other words, people in England were interested in thinking about a lot of different things. Their sort of social horizon was quite disparate. And what you said, 140 topics, I think. And that's a large number. And then on the other hand, you contrast that with American discourse, where you looked at American collections and you found a smaller number of topics. So then you jump to what I would say is not really a computer point, but a very interesting point, saying that maybe there's something to say that the Londoners talked about more different things than the Americans. Does that mean that there is a broader public discursive tradition in London where people talked about more things? So I'm curious about helping us, tracing for us a little bit this move then from the number of topics generated by the computer to a sort of your speculation about why you find more topics in the London traditions. And is there any other possible explanation? How do we move from the computer-generated data to sort of historical speculation?
Yeah, so this is a project that's near and dear to my heart. So you mentioned the idea of the topic. And so just to, I think, let the listeners know, what you're referring to is this process that's generally called topic modeling. There's a lot of different algorithms you can use, but where you have the computer read all of the text and you let it, if done well, tell you, like, how many different topics are we talking about here? What is being talked about? And it does this by this idea of context. So there's this, philosopher, Firth, who has this idea that you know the meaning of a word by the company it keeps. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is, if words are co-occurring together frequently, that's an indicator that something is trying to be said, and that it's the same kind of thing every time those words co-occur, that we're trying to get to something.
And that's what we call a topic.
And that's what we call a topic, are these co-occurrence of words. And it was a shock even to me, as someone who has read, there's not very many people on the planet who have physically read more of these things than I have. there are people, but there's not many, There's just not a lot of people have spent. So as someone who's read thousands of these on my own as a human reader, I was still amazed
at how
I expected the discursive universe to be much more narrow. Mm-hmm. Right? So, if I, as someone who studies this period and has read these things, my view of what people are talking about was very limited, actually. And it was really a mind blower. Yeah, that we found, I think it was actually 165 in the ballads and 140 in the American newspaper collection.
Ah.
Right. And so I would have expected much the inverse by a lot, that if you were looking at newspapers in America, that, again, the Library of Congress consciously curated, they went out and tried to find the obscure and to be really representative and make sure that they were speaking from all types of communities.
Right. As opposed to your hodgepodge collection.
As to my hodgepodge collection, that we would see way more topics. Right. And the fact that we don't, to me, is game changing, actually. I mean, I really think we have to rethink the richness of public life in the early modern period in London.
I understand that, and that's why I was curious when I was reading the article. I thought this was something I wanted to discuss with you. Can you think of an alternate explanation? I mean, I think that's one of the things we do as historians, is right to think, is there some other reason why these traditions have filtered down to us in what we have preserved? Because in both cases, we are also talking about preservation, what is preserved, that the particular social niche that the newspaper filled in one culture versus the pamphlet in another culture, or I think this is, as you say, something very near and dear to our heart, which is, what do we then do with an idea thrown out? Well, we find so many topics here, so many topics here. This is where it gets really tricky, actually, right?
Oh, yeah. And you just hit on one of the explanations, potentially, right?
Right.
I don't think that explanation has the magnitude of effect that maybe you imagine it does, because if we look at anything like a modern context, the different potential outlets for conversation are way more, right? I mean, you really don't have in the 16th and 17th century a thriving competition in a book trade. It doesn't exist. Books are super expensive. They're not read by most people. So it's just that difference, right? So if I'm looking at 20th century America, I have to go, well, newspapers versus books versus radio versus there were a lot of, we get to the modern era, it's versus Twitter and Facebook. And, the number of outlets is there, because that is reduced, there's less competition for media space. So I do think there's still, yes, the niche still matters here.
But not that much.
Not as much as it would today, as we would have to deal with that. There are other explanations, though. One is just that there are some technological problems that I want to be honest about. I think it matters to be clear about. One is that there is no standard spelling of anything in this period, right? I mean,
interesting
none.
Interesting point.
Now, we've corrected for that in our model to the extent that we can. So I'll give a shout out to Martin Mueller at Northwestern University as a crew there. I've been working for years on so there's a process called lemmatization, which is you reduce all the variant spellings and even like I am, you are, he is, you know, to just be, right? Mm-hmm. So that you eliminate all of that. And they've been working for years on creating a dictionary of all the spelling variants in early modern English. Mm. And we use that to lemmatize. So we have accounted for a lot of that. But even with that, and then on top of that, I have a whole process of students working with me here that we check and correct. I still think we're only, I think our last check, we think we're about 92%, accuracy. Mm-hmm. So there's some wiggle room there, right? Where there actually it's the same word, but
it's still
twice.
It's amazing. And you can see now very much how you, as you say, that the lot of work, decades of work has gone into the nanosecond that's going to take place when you do all of that analysis. So, well, we've reached the end of the first half of the segment. So we are going to take a quick break and we will be back in just a moment. So stay tuned and we will be back for some more on the digital humanities. So this is Office Hour, Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And we're back for the second half of our show today, talking about the digital humanities with Carl Stamer from the you got many different homes, right, including the English department and the data sciences and all of those. So in the first segment, we saw his example using these British pamphlets, 7,000 of them, more than 7,000 of them. When you digitize them and then you use the computer to analyze them, you can do two things. We saw both. You can do all the things that humans can do much faster. But in addition, you can do a lot of kinds of analysis that humans simply cannot do by being able to time travel and see the history of the text being produced. And you can find out a lot of modes of information that I don't think would have been capable for even the most advanced human scholars. So I want to use the second segment to sort of speculate a little bit about these questions, because I think it's fairly new still to a lot of people in the humanities. So now that you've done this all, what do you see as sort of the next frontier in your project? Are we going to be finding new things that the computer can find? You've already scanned this material. So do you sort of in a way, and you've done quite a bit of looking at this material. So what is the next frontier? Another level of questions that we can bring to the material, better scanning of the material? What sort of your next 20 years are you going to be doing?
continuing to clean the mess in the text. This is always that, again, the normalization, the spelling and stuff will always be there. But I think the real next move is, we want to move into that truly interpretive space.
Okay.
Right?
So how do we do that? Give us an example.
And so I want to know, and I think I think this raises issues for the humanities in general, right? Of sort of really coming to understand, like, why do I care? Like, why do I care about the sense of history, right? What does it mean for me to know this, right? How can I then, deploy that knowledge? Mm-hmm. Especially, like, I'm in a classroom, I'm talking to students, like, what is the net gain there, right? That I'm, what am I trying to communicate? And, the computer, I think, will continue to develop algorithms that the idea, at least from my perspective, where we should be spending our time and money is things, again, if we can increase scale, although I think we've kind of maximized what we can do with counting and that type of thing, it's finding ways that the computer can show us a feature of the text, something that is there that I cannot see, that I am missing for whatever reason. I'm missing it because I bring a particular bias to the text when I read it, and or I have no historical context, or there's a thousand reasons why we look at something and we don't actually see that, or, you know, like the one where it's just scratched out, right? I can't see it physically.
Right.
But I think we'll find increasingly supple and interesting ways of letting the computer reveal patterns in texts that we miss as humans. Mm-hmm. We are cognitively incapable of seeing beyond a network that has three or four levels to it, right?
Right.
And so, but once we get to that, and I touched on this in the beginning, you know, at the end of the day, we have to interpret that. What does that mean?
Right, right.
Right? And that will always be, that's the human role. It's, okay, now I see what's there. Mm-hmm. Now let me say, what does that mean
to me,
as a human?
I mean, how do you look for features that you haven't imagined yet? I mean, in other words...
You don't know what you don't know, right?
I think that's a really interesting question. How do you go ahead and how do you... I understand that where we want the computer to find things we haven't looked for before, but first we have to tell the computer to look for them, don't we, in a certain way?
We do and we don't. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certainly some art and accident that happens here, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the topic modeling provides a good example of that in a way, which is we know we're telling the computer, just find all the words which congeal together as a group that co-occur frequently, right? And what happens is the computer does that and it comes back with a list. Here's your 165 topics. Here's your 165 different groups of words that show up next to each other, right? Now, of those, there are many that you look at as a human and it's like, here's a list of words and it's king, knave, you know, subject, but like it makes total sense to you as a human reader. You go, I get that's for sure a topic, right? But there's always a pile that you look at and you go, that's just makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Though I don't see why those words, it doesn't make any sense they're together. The computer got it wrong. It's nonsense. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest mistake that you can ever make if you're going to be in the computational humanities. Because
computer's never wrong.
The computer's never wrong. They are co-occurring, right? They're together for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. And what I think the good digital scholar does is then goes and says, okay, what is the reason? Like, what is it there, right? It may not be an interesting reason. It could just be as simple as, so one of the things we see in these models a lot, if you don't clean a lot, are like just two-letter words. You'll see a topic that's just all... So like every state abbreviation, if you're mining newspapers, right? And that gets put as a topic because it turns out that stylistically, all the time, people, they're talking about one state, they're frequently talking about another, and they're frequently using these two-letter abbreviations, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a logical reason that doesn't turn out to be very interesting from a scholarship point of view. It just reflects some quirkiness of the press or something like that, right? Mm. But there is just as frequently these ones that you go, there's actually something there that I just didn't see, right? And so we have to trust it as collaborator. And so we gave it some instructions of how to search, mm-hmm. but we didn't tell it go find those words, right? And that's the same. I think that will always be the same with our algorithm development. We may find that there's a new way. So, for example, there's some really interesting work. It's been going on for a little bit of time. A guy in King's College looking at genetic analysis of paper. Right?
Genetic analysis. Like paper has a DNA.
Exactly. Because right. It comes from certain plants. And it also turns out it has DNA of particular bugs. And one of the most interesting features is actually it has DNA of feces of sheep, a particular kind of paper.
Okay.
Because it was made in a certain region. Uh-huh. And that actually has allowed, you know, this scholar to say, okay, like I actually know that this stuff was printed in this particular region where there was a lot of sheep farming going on, mm-hmm. right? And because it's in the air and the paper is actually picking that up. Mm-hmm. So he didn't know that he was looking for that particular kind of DNA. He just knew, well, I can test for DNA now. What would happen if we looked at that, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of room for electron microscopy and other kinds as we learn to look into the human body and to look at things in new ways in other fields. Mm-hmm. To say, well, what happens if I look at my thing that way?
Yeah.
What do I get?
Well, there's no doubt that you're expanding what I would call sort of the historical questions by, like you're saying, like bringing in what area was this and what were the sheep eating that month.
Yeah.
And But you did open with a fairly dramatic question about, like, what is the importance of this? I didn't know. Are you going to cycle back to that and tell us,
well,
do we have, do you think there is, I mean, this is a perennial question for the humanities. Yeah. I agree totally. I'm wondering if you feel that there is a new answer to that question that comes out of the material that you're working on, that there's a new way to pose to people what the importance of digital humanities are, rather besides we've got these new tools and they're fun to use, and we're historians, so we're interested in obscure questions anyway. But do you think there's a sort of a new added value or clarification of a value?
I, you know, so of course I think my period offers unique insights here. And it also is part of how I stayed rooted there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there, as we start to understand how text, image, sound is used together interchangeably in different ways in a stable historical period.
Okay.
We start to learn things that that gives us a model of information flow.
Mm-hmm.
That I predict those models are going to allow us to make sense of the current era in ways that we're missing.
Okay, well, that's a pretty interesting claim.
Flows.
That's a really interesting claim. And we're going to come back in a decade and redo this show. Exactly.
Perfect.
And we're going to ask this exact question of whether the models that are learned through, you know, running these texts through all kinds of analyses that we couldn't do in the past, does that help us understand our own time? And I think that actually is really a very important and very profound question, and leads me to exactly that question anyway, which I was going to ask you, which is about the application. So much of what you're working on is clarifying history. And one of the well, you know, often we have people who come and talk as historians about how difficult it is to clarify evidence from what is evidence in the 16th century. Is a document real or not? And also, we live in an age of fake news. And I was curious as to whether you think there's anything that you've learned from the power of the computer to reconstruct historical questions. What about right now? Are we using, is it simply a question of that we're not using the power that exists in a particular way? And sometimes when I ask this, that's what people tell me. Well, we're just not interested in doing that with computers. Or, you know, I'm interested in that question. Can we use this, harness these, as you say, very powerful modes of analyzing text in some form to try to help us find out not only the past, but what is real now?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yes, yeah, I said
another
it.
Great answer.
I'm going to say it. Absolutely.
It's absolutely. Okay. So, you know, what are we not doing that we should be doing?
So, the biggest obstacle that we have to doing this for today is, and there's this weird inversion going on here. We think of ourselves as living in the age of information and being inundated with information.
Yep.
Right. The fact of the matter is, we do not have access to most of that information to run these kind of algorithms and do the mining. The problem for us as scholars with the fake news problem is that Facebook owns the news.
Uh-huh.
We don't have access to that. I can't get it. I mean, the biggest, you know, the hardest part of my job is, because part of my job isn't just my research. My job at the university is to facilitate
yes.
this work for other researchers in other fields. And so I work with a lot of other you know, projects and scholars across the university in the humanities, in medicine, you know, I mean, every sector of the university. And the biggest, you know, 80% of the time, someone walks in with an idea, and I have to tell them that is an incredible idea. There is no way we can do it because we do not have access to that data.
Because you have access to your pamphlets.
I have access to that.
And nobody says you can't have that.
Yeah. And the reason I have that, I want to be totally clear, is because the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Mellon Foundation, and a lot of organizations have supported that project for going on 18 years now to pay the costs of having us digitize that. But even that total cost is a pittance compared to what Twitter and Facebook and the New York Times and everybody else wants to charge us if they're even willing to let us have that. Now, this is changing a little bit. So I'll say I'm in conversation now with, like, the New York Times, right?
Right.
For a long time, we've had a license with them that was just locked down. Nope, you just cannot have it, period. You know, for some sets, you talk to LexisNexis and it's $20,000 for, you know, 10 papers, right?
Yes.
You know, and so this is just a real issue. We are bound by this restriction that in the age of information, the corporation has the information. We do not.
And why does the New York Times not want to share it? Because they just feel it's more valuable for them to have it themselves?
I actually do want to give them a little bit of a shout out. The reason I'm in ongoing conversation with them now is because they're looking to find a model where they can share it.
Uh-huh.
Right. So
okay.
I do think things are changing. Yes. I just, they're in my mind because they're actually working with us. Right. And as are a lot of players. So, you know, people may or may not know we're in the middle of a sort of Elsevier moment with these large bodies,
yes,
that control information.
Yes.
Right. You know, Elsevier actually supports a postdoc in my lab,
right,
who, you know, is trying to work on these problems. You know, and we see Gale has their digital scholarship lab that they're launching now too. Kind of stole my name, but, you know, but I'll let that go. You know, of trying to make the analysis available in situ over there, right? So they'll run some algorithms for you and give you stuff back. So I think people are trying, but even in those circles, there's a really interesting thing around also privacy too. Like a lot of the data we want to run at the university is it's information about how people and information that people are producing, you know, moves through the world, right? And this is going to – I'm just going to say it in all its kind of bluntness. I mean, it's good that as a university we really care about privacy, and I do want to honor that. And one of the things I say about privacy all the time is you have to sort of get really Foucauldian about it. The only path to freedom in the modern world is just open yourself up to the panopticon. I fully recognize that, you know, as an upper middle class white male, I'm the guy that can afford to do that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like it's a very problematic issue, and I want to honor that. But what's really interesting is most of the people in the world – they're giving their privacy away for free.
That is certainly
to
true.
To the corporations.
Yes.
But if you work for a public institution, we're locked out.
Right.
There's a weird dynamic there that is an institution and is a culture. Like, it should be the opposite, right?
I mean, it should be. Okay, yeah. All you people out there, you're giving your stuff to the wrong people, okay? You're giving away your free information. You're wasting your information. Give it to Carl.
Yeah. My ability to do anything to hurt you with it is nil.
He will do something important with it, and he can't get a hold of it. And in the meantime, you're giving it to Mark Zuckerberg for free.
Yeah, it's that simple, really.
Yeah, and that. So what do we do in this situation? It's probably impossible to know what we do in this situation, and that's not even something you can solve. So maybe instead we'll end up, I'm just leaving that as, do you have a sort of, we always often at the end think about a sort of a thought question for like the average listener to think about what the interface between computers and humanities is and is going to be, sort of what's mulling around in your mind. It seems partly maybe to be the issue of what new things can we learn that we're not even sure that we're looking for them, and then how do we turn the computer into more like us, more interpretive, willing to make some speculations of its own in the future?
Yes. I think that, so one of the critiques that comes frequently here is that the computer will never be interpretive.
Uh-huh.
Right? But I frequently ask people, well, what is the context of your interpretation? Right? It's a particular history that you have that's personal and unique of things that you've read, life experiences you've had, right? I mean, that is the majority of context. And then a particular way that information flows through your brain, right? Based on that history, right? That there's, you know, it's an epiphenomenon, right, that's happening. And the truth is there is really no reason to think. I mean, we one of the great things about the internet, and again, like the data thing, is we could unleash a computer that can have a similar history,
mm-hmm,
gain a tremendous amount of context, right? Build that same kind of uniqueness. And we have AI algorithms that are self-replicating in that way, that they want to program themselves based on the context that they're experiencing, right? So we will have definitely intelligent agents, right? And I think the real question for the human is, am I really willing to, you know, we talk about AI all the time, but am I really willing to live in a world where I will treat the machine as an equal?
Right.
right?
Well, when we're someday we will have robot graduate students. I mean, where would we not have a? I mean, in a way, that's what you're saying, that if you took a computer and you taught it all the things, that it then had all the experiences that a graduate student would have, and it would then begin to make use of its experience in the same way our graduate students do. And presumably it would have a very powerful way of making use of it simply because of the computational power. As you point out, it also computers can pay attention to more things at the same time than humans can.
Right.
So there's a kind of way in which it would be.
That may be their failing, though, too. Right?
What do you mean?
I mean, it may be that and there's, you know, anecdotal research because I pay. AI isn't my total world, you know, as a cog scientist, right? But you do pay attention to that. There's a lot of research sort of suggesting that, you know, our ability to forget is crucial to the survival of the species. I mean, if we remembered how painful and hard lots of things are, truly remembered it, we would never do it again. Mm-hmm. The feedback loop just doesn't pan out, right?
Right.
And so there's a lot of ways in which our inability to focus broadly and to focus that we're sort of, we forget, we make mistakes, we're forced to narrow things down, really serves us well, actually. And there's no real reason to want to build a computer to do that. I'm like not really interested in building a fake human, right? So I think that recognizing that we have that may be our big asset, and let's not run from that. Let's really own that, actually, that we have particular modes of thinking that we're great at that the computer doesn't do.
And that will keep us plenty busy.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got 20 years putting all of those things, and now you've got what you're going to be doing for the next 20 years.
Right.
So, well, I think that leaves a lot of questions for us, as always, more questions than we can answer. So I want to thank Carl Stemmer very much for coming, the Director of Data and Digital Scholarship. That's a great title.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming today. And if you want to listen to this show over again, you can find it on officehourucdpodcast.com, where it will be archived. And there will be a link there to your websites, because there's a lot of other things we couldn't deal with today. So they can find out the other projects. And maybe you want to go to consult and bring your project, because that's what he's here. He will tell you what features you never even thought of existed in the material you work with that you can work on your own. And in the meantime, maybe until next week when we're going to knock on another door, you can think about who you're giving your data to. You know, maybe that's a good thing to think about. You're giving your data away for free, and maybe find somebody else to contribute it to. So stay tuned for Radio Theater, and thanks very much. And we'll be back next week when we knock on another door. Bye for now.